Okay, Matthew 17, and just because, number one, I read rapidly, and number two, I don't want to spend too much time in the readings because we're going to have three of them. I'm going to just do it quickly myself, if you'll just follow along. Matthew 17, we'll start off with verse 1, go down through verse 8. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, his clothes became as white as the light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with them. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, let us make here three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their faces and were greatly afraid. But Jesus came and touched them and said, Arise and do not be afraid. When they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. Okay, Mark chapter 9 is the second of the readings. First 8 verses there, I believe. Yes. Beginning in verse 1 of Mark chapter 9, he said to them, Assuredly I say to you, start in verse 2. Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, led them up on a high mountain apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His clothes became shining, exceedingly white like snow, such as no launderer on earth can whiten them. And Elijah appeared to them with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Rabbi, it's good for us to be here, and let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Because he did not know what to say, for they were greatly afraid. And a cloud came and overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, saying, This is my beloved Son, hear him. And suddenly when they had looked around, they saw no one anymore, but only Jesus with themselves. Okay? And then finally, Luke chapter 9, and verse 28. Luke 9 and verse 28. We'll go down through verse 36. Luke 9:28. Now it came to pass about 8 days after these sayings that he took Peter, John, and James and went up on the mountain to pray. As he prayed, the appearance of his face was altered, and his robe became white and glistening. And behold, two men talked with him, who were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his decease, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Peter and those with him were heavy with sleep, and when they were fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And then it happened as they were parting from him that Peter said to Jesus, Master, it is good for us to be here, and let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. While he was saying this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were fearful as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, This is my beloved Son, hear him. When the voice had ceased, Jesus was found alone. But they kept quiet and told no one in those days any of the things that they had seen. So you see the details, a little bit of difference in regard to the details. The interesting thing about Luke chapter 9, you'll notice that we find something of what Moses and Elijah were talking to Jesus about. The other two accounts do not indicate that. We're told that in verse 31, they appeared in glory, spoke of his decease. And that actual word there, it is having reference to his departure or exodus. It is a word that is used, exodus or exiting. But it has reference, of course, to his death, which is something that Jesus had just talked to them about 6 days previous. So these are the three accounts. One other interesting thing to note is the book of Luke does not use the word transfigure. We'll talk a little bit about why that might be. But that's different from Matthew and Mark, which says that he was transfigured before them. The Greek term transfigured is found there. So we got someone who's visiting with us today, so they'll be here in a minute, I guess. Okay, so let's go back to Matthew 17, and we'll make reference to these other verses a little bit as we talk about it. We want to note that this is a really wonderful and interesting passage of Scripture. Y'all come on in. We're in Matthew chapter 17, is where we are, talking about the Transfiguration. And it's a wonderful passage because of what is described in this particular text. And I came across a point made in one of the commentaries that I wanted to share with you. So I'd like you to keep in mind what the Transfiguration is. We have this offering of Jesus, and the alteration or metamorphosis or transfiguration is something that was substantive. It wasn't merely appearance. There was a transfiguration. We want to talk about what the term means in just a few moments' time. But what we see there is basically the testimony of God that Jesus was who he claimed to be. This is an indication of his deity, his divinity. It is seen both in the form that was taken, but it was also seen in regard to the statement that was made by God in this place, which mirrored the statement made in Matthew chapter 3, John chapter 3, at John's baptism, or Jesus' baptism by John in the Jordan, where the same phrase was used, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." So, keeping that in mind, I want you to go with me, if you will, to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. An interesting point that that was brought up by one of the commentators is that this event in the mind of Paul ties in together with what we might refer to as the darkest moment or darkest hour as Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. And the verses 6 and 7 of Philippians chapter 2 is the passage that he used to tie these two together. So I want you to notice that we are told that Jesus was in the form of God. He was at the right hand of the Father in heaven in the form of God, Philippians 2, 6. And on earth, the clearest indication, the most obvious indication that he was God the Son, and this exalted being is here at the Transfiguration, both in the testimony of the Father given on that occasion as well as the Transfiguration itself. Remember what we're talking about the Transfiguration being. Here was Jesus, here was Elijah, and here was Moses. And a lesson was being taught here in this Transfiguration that Jesus is greater than the Law and the Prophets, greater than Moses and Elijah. So it's an important point to be made. Why is that? Because he was made a little lower than the angels, but he has that name which is highly exalted above all names. He was God the Son. So that's seen in the Transfiguration. As you continue on in verse 6, it says he did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a slave or a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. And so you see the polar opposite of this Transfiguration on the Mount in the presence of the disciples, when in the Garden of Gethsemane, by the way, in the garden, you'll remember, and I forget now which account indicates this, that he told his disciples to wait, took these same three individuals with him. In fact, I can tell you, it's in Mark 14. Took the same three individuals, Peter, James, and John, with him further into the garden, told them to wait, retired a bit further, and he prayed. And you'll remember his prayer, "Father, if it is your will, take this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." So there we find the exaltation of Jesus seen in the mount as he was transfigured before them, but we also see this lowly state of Jesus doing the will as a bondservant of his Father in heaven in this deepest, darkest hour where he is both Son of God and also eminently human, the Son of Man as well. And I just thought that was an interesting thing that the tie-in with Philippians chapter 2 would be seen in these two events. And so it was an interesting point to be made in that regard. But I just want you to understand, as we look at this, that this is a very significant event. And it is one that is actually referenced, I believe, certainly by Peter in his epistle. But I do also believe that John chapter 1 and verses 1 and 2, that John, at least in part, had this particular event in reference when we beheld his glory. In mind as well. So this is a significant thing that had a great impact upon his disciples that saw that. Now as to the question as to why Peter, James, and John were chosen, I don't know that we can really know that. You know, some people say that Jesus may have been closer to those three than others. And that may have been the case, but that's an assumption. There's no indication of that scripturally, unless this is that indication. But as far as, the Gospel of John, John refers to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. And but that, you know, that may have been an indication of John expressing how great Jesus' gifts and mercy extended to him was. In other words, he may not have been singling himself out as one that Jesus was closer to than others, but simply acknowledging how much Jesus loved him as an individual. So we don't know exactly the why of it, but these three men, Peter, James, and John, were set aside. And there are actually three occasions when that happens. So we got Transfiguration, we got the Garden of Gethsemane. And then the third one, if anybody just wants to make note of it, is in Mark chapter 5 and Luke 8 with the healing of Jairus' daughter, where those three men were chosen and set apart from the others. Okay, so keeping that in mind, a couple of things to note. You'll notice back in chapter 16, just Matthew 16 and verse 21, we're told there that from that time Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed. Just think about this. It says it was after 6 days. Luke indicates it was almost 8 days. So in that period of time, just about a week in time, they had been told that he had to die and that he was going to suffer. You'll remember in Matthew 16, we talked about this last week, that Peter opposed him in that and was called an adversary, or Satan, get thee behind me, Satan, because he opposed what was going to happen to Jesus. This was something that had to happen. Jesus had to die. But understand the point of view that the Jews had in general, and the misconception that the disciples still labored under. Their idea of the Messiah is one who would be in a position of exaltation. He was going to come, and he was going to reign on the throne of David, and he was going to be successful. And here Jesus is telling them, you know, I'm going to have to die, and I'm going to suffer, and it's going to happen. And as a result of that, you can sense uncertainty on the part of the disciples. And imagine the sorrow and the state of mind that they would have had for this week leading up to the Transfiguration. The Transfiguration reveals that he would indeed be glorified. He would indeed be exalted. This Transfiguration was a significant event in their mind that, oh, he may die, but this isn't going to be his defeat or his end. So this is something that no doubt gave, though it scared them, and I certainly understand why it would, it gave them some understanding of just how great and grand this whole thing was, that this appearance there on the Mount of Transfiguration. The only other thing that I wanted to add as far as preparatory remarks in this is where. You'll notice that we are told that they were taken to a very high mountain, or a high mountain by themselves. You may remember that in Matthew chapter 16 they were in Caesarea Philippi. Now, where this mountain is, there's no way of knowing for certainty where the mountain was. But do remember that Caesarea Philippi is located in the northern part of Israel, and it is the location of the headwaters of the Jordan River, springs coming out of the base of what mountain? Anybody remember the name of the mountain up there? Mount Hermon. That's exactly right, Mount Hermon, which is actually the very highest mountain in Palestine. Now, remember, mountains are relative. I mean, you know, when you say, it's like when you see a city, or when you talk about it was a day's journey. You know, a day's journey for us, it may be 600 miles. A day's journey for them was five as they walked. And the cities may have been just small villages. And Mount Hermon is 9,200 feet above sea level. That's how big it is. But it is tall enough to where much of the year it is covered in snow, the caps, the tops of the mountain covered in snow. And it can be seen from a long ways away. Certainly I remember seeing from the Sea of Galilee, looking north and seeing the Mount Hermon in the distance. So it could be seen throughout much of Israel. So That's the guess that most commentators and scholars would come up with. It's probably as Mount Hermon. Not sure how high up they went, but they did separate themselves in a high mountain, and that was where he was transfigured. Okay, so those are some of the introductory thoughts I wanted to share with you about it. The significance, of course, is talking about the transfiguration itself and what that transfiguration means. So let's start off by noting that there are a couple of items that that Luke supplies that the other accounts do not. Luke chapter 9, we're told that he was praying, and as he was praying, there was a transfiguration. Matthew and Mark do not mention the praying. Whenever you see those kinds of differences in the narratives, don't think of them as discrepancies, but rather the supplying of an account of information by one that's not supplied by another. And typically, there are ways, whenever you see these kinds of things, to reconcile the various accounts. But in this particular case, it's a simple process. He simply mentions this, and the others do not mention it. But the interesting thing about this is that Matthew 17 indicates that he was transfigured. Mark chapter 9 mentions that he was transfigured. But we mentioned, again, that Luke doesn't use the word transfigured. All Luke says is that as he prayed, the appearance of his face was altered, and his robe became white and glistening. Now, does anyone have any idea as to why Luke would not use the word transfigure? That's not an obvious thing, but I thought maybe someone had looked at this before. So, I'm not trying to be dogmatic about this, but it is an interesting point to be made. Yes, Ed?
Would it be because Peter and John were there and actually saw it, and Luke is telling what happened?
Well, if you think about that, Matthew and Mark weren't there either, and Luke wasn't there. So all three of them weren't in the three narratives. They all would be getting it secondhand. So I don't think that's the reason. I'm not going to be dogmatic about saying what the reason is. I just want to note a couple of things. First of all, the word transfigure is the Greek word metamorpho, or metamorpho. But anyway, you've heard that. You see that phrase as metamorphosis. So when you think about talking about typically a metamorphosis, you would have a caterpillar altering or changing its form to become a butterfly. That's the term that we use for metamorphosis. It's a Greek term, and in actuality, there was a very famous epic poem that had been written by a Roman philosopher, Roman poet, excuse me, his name is Ovid, O-V-I-D, that is titled Metamorphosis. And it was a famous poem. It was very popular in that particular time that he wrote it. He actually wrote it just a few years before Christ was born. So I just want you to be aware of that. And an interesting thing is that the poem is about the pagan gods altering themselves to become in form as humans or animals and those kinds of things. That's what the whole poem is about. Is a metamorphosis. Okay, so that's the term that is used, and it has reference. The term has reference to change into another form. There are a number of other passages of Scripture where that same phrase is used. Philippians 2 is one, taking the form that's morphe. It's a shortened form of this metamorpho, but it took a different form, indicating that the form that he had before is different from the form that he has now. He had the form of God, took on the form of man. Some people say, well, he wasn't really a man. He just looked like a man. No, he took the form of a man. So that's the last part of that term. The metamorpho has reference to the change of form. That's the idea. And the same term is used in Romans 12. Romans 12, that you not be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That indicates that the mind is going to take a different form. It's not going to be superficial. It's not going to be a surface change. It's going to be a significant fundamental change that happens. That's what conversion is. And I think that's an interesting way to describe that in Romans chapter 12 as well. So it's a characteristically new mind. And it's actually a different word that is commonly used with regard to the word of form or change, which is schema, the other Greek term, which would have reference to something that's more superficial. So this is an indication of something that's significant, a fundamental change that has taken place. Who was the primary audience for Matthew? As we look at the structure of the book and the teaching of the book, what group of individuals was Matthew centering his gospel trying to convince? The
Jews.
The Jews. And how do we know that?
The genealogy is one thing.
The genealogies would be a primary. Sure. So, and the emphasis upon him as a teacher and rabbi. So, with regard to the audience for Matthew, it would be the Jewish audience. Would the Jewish audience, if you use the word transfigured, be inclined to get a pagan concept of what is intended from that? Not necessarily, because they understand God, the one God. Who did Luke write to? Luke's was primary to the Gentiles. And so when the question is asked, why did Luke not? The only thing that comes to mind in that regard is that Luke was being careful not to use a term that the Romans and the Gentiles were intimately familiar with and had a false concept of to describe what happened. Because I think it is a significant thing that where Matthew and Mark both say that he was transfigured, Luke says he was altered, his face was altered, and do not use that word metamorpho, ruo, whatever it is, in order to describe that, whereas Luke does not. So that's just thought that was kind of an interesting thing. Luke being written for a Gentile audience may wanted to avoid that confusion and with the pagan superstition that may have come about. But the transfiguration itself was an obvious change. An interesting thing to note in this is that Jesus was transfigured. Moses and Elijah appeared. They weren't transfigured. They appeared. They appeared. I don't know. they were there. Okay? Now, in what form? It's a curious question, isn't it? As far as were the in this transfiguration and change, the way that it's described in this particular text very similar to descriptions that are given of spiritual beings in other places. Let me give you just a couple of examples. In Mark chapter 9, which is another account there of the transfiguration, we're told his clothes became shining. They began to shine, exceedingly white like snow, such as no launderer on earth can whiten them. So this was an unnatural whiteness, exceedingly white, and it was a shining. We don't have to imagine this quite as much as others in the past because we have special effects in the movies all the time. So how many times have you seen something like that, a scene to where you see this kind of a luminescence or something? We can kind of get in our mind's eye what was under consideration here. Here in Matthew, his face was transfigured, his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. So this kind of language that is used here is used in other places as well. Let me give you a couple of examples. The first one I wanted to note, actually the first two, is in Daniel. And so we have the visions of Daniel. In Daniel chapter 10 and verses 5 and 6, there is a description of an angel, a messenger of God. And in verse 5 of Daniel 10, he describes in this way. He said, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like torches of fire, his arm and feet like burnished bronze in color, and the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. Now, that's figurative language, I understand, in the sense that he's saying like, but he's describing in this vision the appearance of a man who was more than a man in his appearance. Two chapters later, there is a description in Daniel chapter 12 and verse 3 of that, if it's understood correctly, is an indication of the resurrection. Those who are resurrected. And it says, those who are wise, they shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So again, there's this description. And when you see, for example, in 1 Corinthians 15, the parallel of the Apostle Paul's writings, when he talks about in we will in a moment in twinkling of an eye be changed at the last trumpet. This corrupt will put on incorruptibility, this mortal put on immortality. We don't know what we will be like, but we know that we will be like He is. There is a significant fundamental change with regard to that corruptible body and the incorruptible body that will appear. The other passage is Revelation chapter 1. And this was, again, a vision. This time, a vision that appeared to John on the Isle of Patmos in the description given of Jesus, of the Lord, at that time, where it says, He had in His right hand seven stars, and out of His mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and His countenance was like the sun shining in its strength. Now, I don't know of any necessary significance with regard to those descriptions other than the fact that this transformation, this transfiguration of Jesus, is one that is described by Luke and by Matthew and by Mark. No doubt by the descriptions given to them by Peter, James, and John, as being indicative of this transformed body that we see described in other places as well, or these spiritual beings that we find in other places. So it must have been a significant thing. If we're going to give any conclusion or make any conclusion with regard to it, is again, more than any other time, as Jesus was upon the earth, this was the most, the closest that you get to seeing God the Son as God the Son. I mean, no man can see the Father and live. We understand that, and we can't see the essence. And you see the manifestations of God in the Old Testament, in the burning bush, and the pillar of fire, and the pillar of clouds, and all of those kinds of things. But here is an indication that this was not merely a man, and that's the significance of the transfiguration. So now keep that in mind. There are a couple of other things we want to know: the purpose, what Moses and Elijah represented, those kinds of things. Anybody want to? I mean, it's hard to describe, and it's certainly hard to be dogmatic about some of these things, but it certainly was something that impressed Peter, James, and John. And rightly so. Anybody want to add anything to what we've discussed at this point? Yes, Dennis.
Would love to have been there.
Oh, yeah. Certainly.
But sometimes it's good to think a little bit outside the box to try and get a greater appreciation, you know, for what was actually going on there. And thinking about Jesus from what He just came from, the week before, right? His mission is changing now. He's looking now to Jerusalem. He's preparing His disciples for that, and He was hurt by Peter's words. He really was, because this is a weakness for Him as a man, and He's struggling with that. This transfiguration benefited six persons. It obviously benefited Peter, James, and John. We know that. And that seems to be the purpose for the transfiguration was for them, but also for us seeing through their eyes, because it's recorded for us. It was meant to be. It also benefited Moses and Elijah. Those were the two real people, and they were there. Since the day of their deaths, they have followed the scheme of redemption.
Right.
And this tells us something about life in the hereafter between now and judgment, is we're just not dead in the ground in Hades like some passages in the Old Testament might seem to lead us to believe, but we do have conscience. We learn things once we go to Abraham's bosom. And they did. They knew things that the disciples didn't even know yet. And they were talking to Jesus about those things. So they were benefited. This is their first time to get to see their Lord. They actually got to see their Lord with their own eyes. It benefited Jesus. How did it benefit Jesus? Because He's getting a taste of the glory that He will have again once He's finished His mission. I think it strengthened him greatly over what he had experienced the week before.
Perhaps made the garden more bearable.
Yes. Because this would be strong in his memory as a man for the rest of his life. Because it was a taste of the glory to come.
That's an interesting point. And not one that I had considered, because I was thinking the five that had benefited, right, you know, in that regard. Appreciate that. Yes, Steve?
We were talking about the greatness, and when Paul wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, and 15 and 16, we'll get to it in a couple of weeks, I guess, on Sunday morning, but it says, which he will manifest in his own time, who is the blessed and only potentate, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, who alone has immortality, dwelling in unapproachable light, whom no man has seen or can see. So there's a brightness there that gets even brighter.
Well, again, we recognize this again as a manifestation. And a glorious one, but the idea that is the final state of Jesus, I don't think anybody would indicate that that's the case. Okay, so keeping all of that in mind, we want to go on and point out the part that Moses and Elijah played in this. If we were to refer to Moses, what's the common phrase or name that we give Moses?
The lawgiver.
The lawgiver. Okay, so the lawgiver there. And Elijah was a prophet, and we could say chief among the prophets, although there wasn't any hierarchical situation, but he was certainly a prophet who was considered one of the greatest and was certainly well respected. And I want you to understand, because this is such a neat thing, you know, the description that Jesus gives of himself and how that he is not a servant but the son, not a servant in the house but the son, the descriptions that are given by the New Testament writers concerning this one who became a little lower than the angels, but that has been given a name and been highly exalted above the angels. The idea that is throughout the entirety of the book of Hebrews is that the things of the law were not as good, and I use the phrase good because of a term that, or a phrase that I'm familiar with, the better things of Hebrews has reference to the things that are under the new covenant. So where you have the angels compared to Christ, Christ is greater. When you have the old covenant compared to the new covenant's greater. When you have the priesthood of Aaron compared to the priesthood of Melchizedek, the priesthood of Melchizedek is greater. The animal sacrifices compared to the sacrifice of Christ, the sacrifice of Christ is better. And that's exactly what you're getting in this particular account. You have Moses representing the law, Elijah representing the prophets, and then you have Jesus. And so if you look at that, in fact, that's a common description. I mean, we've got, when we think of the Old Testament, typically we will divide them up in basically three or four sections, depending. I mean, you've got the books of the law, you've got the books of history, you've got the prophets, and you've got the books of poetry. Or wisdom. So there's four basic designations. But often in Scripture, when you have a reference to the Old Covenant, Jesus uses this phrase, the Law and the Prophets. In fact, if you want, I've got other places where you can find it, but Matthew 5:17, Matthew 7:12, and Matthew 11:13, that's the phrase that is used to describe that Old Covenant. And so this again signifies exactly what was happening, and that is that transfer from the old covenant, which is not as good, and the new covenant in Christ, the new the person of Christ, the significance of Him as God the Son, as the one sent last of all as the Savior of mankind, and how this is superior to, greater than, the lawgiver and the chief prophet. That Jesus is the one that is to be heard. He is the one to be heeded. Now, this is something, and Dennis alluded to this, who benefited from this? In addition to the three disciples, Moses and Elijah both benefited from it. I want to remind you of a text in Deuteronomy chapter 18, Deuteronomy 18, where Moses told the children of Israel, in Deuteronomy 18 and 15, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet, capital P, because the translators know that this is a messianic reference. He will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren. Him you shall hear. Now, that was obviously a messianic prophecy, alluded to as being a messianic prophecy. Moses was hearing or seeing this personally. That thing that he had uttered as a prophecy, he was realizing in his presence, in that the disciples were given the instructions, this is my beloved son, hear him. He's the one you're listening to. And these two men appearing is an indication of the greatness of the law, the importance of the prophets, that now you've got the Son of God. And you hear him, and Moses and Elijah are gone. And all that remains is Jesus. And there is the significance of that. This is an indication, again, that Christ is the formation of redemption. That in the Christ we have the realization of God's great scheme of redemption. And Christ is the one that is to be listened to and to be heeded. And of course, Peter perhaps did not fully understand that. In this, there are a couple of things that are noted. In Mark 9, he said that they were greatly afraid. Mark does. Luke 9 said when he spoke, saying, "You know, let us create three tabernacles, one for each of you." We're told that Peter did not know what he said, and because he was afraid or he feared. They entered into the cloud. Can you imagine that? This great cloud comes, which of course has God as a presence in that cloud, and the voice speaks from within the cloud, and that cloud descends onto them. So it's not merely they looked up and there was a cloud in the sky. It was a cloud that descended to them. They went up into the cloud. And so they were afraid. And what Peter said, we're told he didn't know what he was saying. Now, what was he saying? So looking at the text, he says in verse 4, "It is good for us to be here if you wish." So he's not being overly bold about this. He didn't know what to say or what he was saying. He said, "If you wish, let us make your three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." I want you to understand this, that the tabernacle, the word tabernacle there, does not necessarily mean an altar. It can simply mean a erecting of a tent of boughs or branches to signify a place. You know, in the Old Covenant, from time to time, or Old Testament, there would be rocks that would be piled, and a name would be given to a particular place to signify an event that had happened or an occasion. So that may have been all that he was talking about. It wasn't perhaps a desire to worship. It may well have been. I mean, can you imagine? There's Moses and Elijah, and I don't know how they knew that it was Moses and Elijah, but they knew it was Moses and Elijah. And they knew these men to have been dead for centuries. And so it may be that the superstition reared its head, and he was supposing that it would be good to worship all three. But what Peter was doing by doing that is, in effect, lowering Jesus to the level of Moses and Elijah. In other words, not one tabernacle, but three tabernacles, one for each. That puts Jesus on equal footing with Moses and Elijah. And that's just the opposite of what was intended by the Lord in this. And that is why we have this rousing conclusion to this when we were saying, while he was still speaking, verse 5. So he's saying, you want us to put three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, one Elijah. While he was speaking, the bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came from heaven. Now, this is where my imagination comes in, because there's a proclamation with regard to the words of God. And I almost hear it differently in my mind's hearing on when John the Baptist was baptizing Jesus than what I hear now. And I don't want to speculate. I just want you to bear with me what I'm intending by this. In Jesus' baptism by John in the Jordan, there is, in effect, a proclamation. This is an introduction of Jesus to the world, that this is my Son, in whom I am well pleased, hear Him. On this particular occasion, and again, Mark and Luke do not put in the "in whom I am well pleased," but Matthew does, which is exactly what he said in Matthew 3:17 at the Jordan River. But what he's telling Peter and the others is, this is my beloved Son, you listen to Him, not Moses and Elijah, you listen to Him. And whether there's anything in the tone, that's exactly what's being established here. Is that no, they're not equal. And no, it's not Moses anymore, and it's not Elijah anymore. They retain the significance. It is now my beloved Son, and He is the one that you are to heed. He is the one that you're to listen to. And so not listening to Him is something that is tantamount to a defiant rebellion against God, because God chose Him, God sent Him, and He's the one that He intends for you to listen to. And that's why you have so many today, and they think it just a minor thing. I mean, you choose Jesus as your Savior, I'm going to go a different direction. No. God said, this is my Son. He's the one, the only one that you're supposed to listen to. That's what I expect of you. It's what I command of you, is to listen to Him. So I think there's a little bit of, I wouldn't say necessarily a rebuke, but a correction, certainly, of Peter in what he said. And it's interesting that Matthew, at least, puts it as being a very quick thing that was done. Immediately as he was speaking, God said, no, not that, but instead this. Okay? So, I got excited studying this. I know you probably see that. It's just interesting what you can get out of this particular passage. Anybody have anything you want to add? Yes.
Carol Jenkins, he's probably not the only one. I don't think he coined the phrase, but he says there's a scarlet thread of redemption that runs through every book of the Old Testament. And that's true. We talked about the law, we talked about the prophets, but everything is recorded in the Old Testament. All those threads go to and join together in Jesus Christ. We remember in Matthew 5:17, Jesus says, do not think I came to destroy the law of the prophets, because there's those who thought that he did. That's what he was being accused of. He said, I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And that's exactly what he was doing. It's not so much that he was better than them. That's kind of a really doesn't explain exactly what's going on, I don't think. It's that was their very purpose, was to him. Jesus just couldn't appear one day and do what he did. The world had to be prepared for him. He came in the fullness of times, and he had to come that time when he came, because everything culminated in that time for him to come, and that's when he was able to do what he did. Romans 10:4 says, "For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." And that's what happened when he came, and that's what that's what he was showing in the Transfiguration. That's what you've been talking about. But one other thing that just occurred to me while we were reading that, God did say, according to Matthew, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." They all heard that, but Jesus heard that too.
Yeah.
And that's good to emphasize.
I want to read you two passages just very quickly. Just to point out that the Transfiguration was something, again, that really had an impact on Peter and John. 2 Peter 1:16-18, "We didn't follow cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of the Lord Jesus, but were eyewitnesses of His majesty. For He received from God the Father honor and glory when such a voice came to Him from the excellent glory, 'This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased.' And we heard this voice, which came from heaven when we were with Him on the holy mountain." Okay? And the other one, which is a little bit less precise, that I think would be a reference, is John in John 1:1-2. "In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, He was in the beginning with God. All things..." It was verse 14. "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. The glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." So those, I think, that John and Peter had that. Well, I know Peter did. I think John did as well in mind when they penned this. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today. Thank you.